Welcome to the Modern Miss Mason podcast. My name is Leah Bowden and you are listening to a bonus episode. Welcome back to the Modern Miss Mason podcast. Today is a bonus episode, which basically means I am in conversation with a very special guest and I'm looking forward to introducing you to her in just a moment. But before I do, I just want to remind you to book in to the June Modern Miss Mason workshop. I am looking forward to sharing the Zoom stage with my very lovely friend from California, Amy Hughes. If you're on Instagram, she is better known as Simple Little Amy. And we are talking about how unschooling and the Charlotte Mason philosophy really do weave together beautifully. And you may have never had that conversation, but you may be living that out every day. And Amy was, again, a very early on kind of connection for me as I was learning about Charlotte Mason. And yet her beautiful eclectic organic approach to that was always so refreshing. And so we've journeyed together. We have hung out at conferences in the States, and we also stay in touch a lot online, chat in the week, and I just really appreciate her wisdom, her mothering journey, and what she's got to say about a slightly different approach to walking out the Charlotte Mason philosophy in your homeschool in the 21st century. I think you're going to love it. I think you're going to really get so much from it. So book in. The link is in the details of this podcast. It's pay what you can. Just throw a donation in the pot. I will send you a Zoom link, or Eventbrite will. And if you can't join us live, then I will send you the replay automatically within 48 hours of the workshop finishing. So book in, everything will be sent to you, and then, you know, I am just looking forward to having you there and to having this conversation together and with Amy. We've pushed it back a week in June because of the Queen's Jubilee and all the celebrations that will be happening here in the UK. So it's on the second Saturday of the month, slightly different, which is the 11th of June. So hope you can join us. Book in today and I'll see you there. Well, today's guest is British illustrator and writer Anna Koska. Anna has written and illustrated two of her own books. The first one's called From Field and Forest, and the second one is called From Coast and Cove. And they are both an artist's year in paint and pen, and they walk you through the seasons, and there are just beautiful essays, incredible illustrations. But before she was able to publish her own books, she actually has worked as an illustrator, I believe, for over 30 years, illustrating other people's projects and books. So she is, just a breath of fresh air. This conversation was one that I was really looking forward to. And she's so inspiring and so full of the life of the artist's way, of everything, the way she approaches her day, how she approaches her work, what she produces, and her continued joy in that is just refreshing. I loved talking with her. I could have chatted with her all day. And I know that you're going to love this too. So I'm not going to waffle on any longer. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Anna Koska. Anna, thank you so much for joining us on the Modern Miss Mason podcast. Great to have you here.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
So why don't we get started with a little introduction? Some people may know of you and may even have be flicking through your beautiful books. You may be brand new. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, maybe where you are in the country? Might be interesting to people.
Okay, so my name's Anna. I've been illustrating about 30 years now. I'm at the ripe old age of 55. And we did a big, major house move about 2 years ago from Sussex, where we'd lived for more than 20 years, to the south coast of Devon. And we moved with the family, lock, stock and barrel. And so I'm now based here and I had to start again pretty much and set up a new studio and sort of resettle myself into my new surroundings. I'm an illustrator, but I'm also a writer.
So for those who are listening who are not in England, what are the major differences between Sussex, you said, didn't you? Were you in Sussex?
Yes.
And Devon? Yeah. What are the, what were, what sort of vision, even landscape wise, what has, is it very different?
Well, to me, it's markedly different in that we are so close to the coast now. And in Sussex, which is down the, down towards the southeast coast of the UK, it sounds near, but it's still quite a journey to get there. And the beaches don't feel like the beaches you might have enjoyed as a child, with lots of sand and some interesting pebbles and interesting sort of rock formations. Here in South Devon, we have all that. And so we also have the weather, which is quite changeable.
Yes.
On the coast, you have onshore breezes bringing in quite different weather patterns, and they literally flick within minutes from full-on sunshine to a sudden deluge of rain, you know, force nine gales. It's quite extraordinary. But because it's quite volatile and quite dramatic, there's an energy that comes with it. Whereas in Sussex, I think it was a bit more laid back, often quite dry. You would have, particularly in summertime, big dry patches, hedges dying back quickly. All the very narrow lanes we had in Sussex were full with spring flowers, but come summer, they'd look tired. Here in Devon, big difference. The hedges just keep on going. In fact, they get fatter and fatter, so the lanes become narrow. And I would say that's one of the defining features of where we are, is that we have very tiny lanes. There's a network that all sort of filter to the coast. It's quite charming.
It is. We love Devon. It's a beautiful, and North Devon and South Devon are so quite different, aren't they? It's very different experiences, but a popular holiday destination for the Brits. So tell us a little bit about your journey into, I'd like to talk to you about your illustration, but then I guess we'll start there, but then how writing then came into that and kind of intertwined. But tell us about your journey into illustration. Is that something that you studied at university? Was it kind of a dream of yours, something you did as a child?
It was something I used to do as a child. I can remember, well, my first memory is literally sitting in someone's back garden and they'd laid down these beautiful grey slabs of slate. And I'm sitting there with a shell, scrawling in to actually draw lines on their slate of pictures, flowers, that sort of thing. And I think I've always loved doodling and drawing. I did art at school. I didn't take it on to high school or anything because I didn't necessarily like the sound of the course that was on offer. So I missed doing A-level in art, and I didn't take it any further than my first exams, which, you know, at the time I felt very sad about it. I did the sciences instead, but I was advised that I shouldn't do art and science together and that I had to make it. So, I mean, you would never tell any child that now. You would say, you know, left, right, use both sides of your brain and your imagination, because one feeds off the other. It's very clear to everybody now, or to educational psychologists, would, you know, nurture that freedom of a child's ability to go from one side to the other. I think at that time, it made teachers nervous. They wanted to be able to guide a child in one direction, because then they could secure in their minds, at least if not the child's, the possibilities of future careers in that area. And art is seen as a serious subject. It's something, you know, people do if they're a bit flaky, perhaps, alternative. And it's a great shame, because I think my original dream of becoming a marine biologist illustrator, which is quite specific, definitely got drowned very shortly after I thought it. So, but I found my way back again. And I found my way back because of my husband, actually. He noticed that I liked drawing things and doodling pretty pictures for friends as gifts. And he said, you know, I know that you hate doing what you're doing, which was working in offices on computers. why don't you, you know, put a portfolio together and go and see a few publishers? So, well, that's a brilliant idea. I was in my very early 20s and I put together a ramshackle kind of real sort of licorice all sorts, a real mixed bag of illustrations, and marched off to see a load of publishers. And one took me aside and said, you know, your work is really good, but you've got such a diverse selection of stuff. People are going to struggle to be able to remember you for one thing and therefore employ you. So why don't you pick just one subject and go with that? So I wish I knew the name of that person. They work for Penguin Publishing. And I did that, returned to a few publishers, and I was taken up immediately. And I chose an area of food illustration, but in its raw state, not cooked food. I mean, it's not very exciting looking at brown food.
No, it's not. That's true. So you began by illustrating other people's books?
Absolutely. And I did in my first year. This is not to boast. It's purely because I think I was hell-bent on getting on with it. I illustrated over 100 books within the first 2 years.
Wow.
Were all linked to food. Some of them were sort of vegetable gardening, but they were all linked in some way to that sort of food core, if you like, even if it strayed off into sort of botanical areas. It was still at heart looking at things which were growing and or of the sea or of the land, and, you know, ingredients before they were cooked. And it was very gratifying. And I think it went well for me because, not because I was particularly good, I will say that, but because I followed the brief and didn't change it, which is a tendency of people to think, you know, that maybe it should be purple rather than blue, colour you've been guided to do. And I did it on time. And so I found quite a level of success. It was really good. And then I had kids, which kind of stopped a little bit, as it can do.
Yes, it does. Little pause in the moving forward. So really there's a lesson in focus there, isn't there? In not only that, the helpful advice from the publisher about focusing in on one thing for people to notice you, but also your dedication to that focus. I mean, that has obviously brought you on from strength to strength, because still to this day, I mean, the books that we'll talk about your books in detail at the end of our conversation, but you have continued, obviously there's a little bit of food, I'm trying to think, in the first one, but it is natural history it's incredible. So at what point did you go from illustrating other people's books to believing in yourself that you could do this for yourself and actually publish yourself?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, it was my husband who pointed me in the direction of, you know, I can see you love doing that. Why don't you have a go at it? It was actually a really lovely friend who said, look, you are writing. And at that point, I was writing a lot of essays on my website. And I called it Little Stories. And I think on a weekly basis, I would sit down at, you know, crack of dawn, often earlier, because that was when the house was quiet. Yeah. So I wasn't illustrating so much anymore. I found I needed some sort of outlet and some sort of some way of sort of journalizing what was going on and the more poignant moments of my life. I really wanted to put down on paper, almost sort of in a mildly cathartic way. I needed to splurge it out and therefore put it to bed and therefore move on for the next day. That is that sort of just decluging your head before you do. So I was writing these little essays and my friend said, you know what, you really should do a book, put them in a book. And I had a lot of people on Twitter saying the same thing, which was incredibly kind, very flattering and really encouraging. And then the same friend said, you know what, I think you're writing these stories, you need to talk to someone, I've got an agent and I think she would really enjoy talking to you. So with very clammy hands and just heartbeat absolutely racing, I met up with this lovely woman who took me under her wing and said, you know what, we have got a book here. Let me guide you in putting together a proposal with some illustrations, because I think it should be an illustrated book, and I'll take them to a publisher. Wow. And my first book became what it is. And that was published last year. And again, because of COVID, it actually was put off a good 6 months. But we got there in the end. Yeah, couldn't find printers, couldn't find the paper. Everything was ground to halt. And I'm sure lots of people have found the same way with, I mean, we obviously got Brexit going on over here in the UK.
Yeah.
Worldwide, there's been huge issues on the knock-on effect of COVID, and it continues. So I felt incredibly fortunate to be trusted to write and illustrate this first book, but then to be able to actually get it out into the public arena was extraordinary.
I'd say, Anna, as well, it was a real gift to us during that time. It definitely was to me. I came across your work through James, I want to pronounce his last name, Rebanks, James Rebanks' wife, Helen. So I love James's books. I've read both of them and started following his wife on Instagram. And I think she was reading from Field and Forest. And I immediately just thought, that looks like my kind of book, and grabbed a copy myself. I mean, it shows you the power of that kind of recommendation and people really loving something. Your books are a gift, and they are, I think, for those of us who love beautiful illustration, but not only that, you're an incredible writer.
That's very kind.
Well, it's true. As a fellow writer, what I think is incredible is that you illustrated your own book. So tell us a bit about that, because writers know, I mean, even just writing a book, just coming up with the words is a huge, huge thing. But here you are, also fully responsible for the images on all throughout that. Were you doing both at the same time, or did you choose to write first and then illustrate? How did that look?
So for the first book, they went hand in glove. I found I needed, after writing, to get that illustration down, because it was fresh in the heart, if that makes sense. It didn't always happen that way around. I'd often do an illustration and think, oh my goodness, but that actually would do well as a subject. And the reason I'm illustrating this is because of that. And so you'd find it hinged the other way around. For this next book, I wrote it flat out. I just had to get the words down.
Yeah.
I used the illustrations, and as I wrote each essay, I would make a note of what I think would work there and what I felt comfortable and inspired to illustrate. And so I left all the illustrations, bar maybe three or four, and I think there's something like 45 or 50 in there. Wow. I left them all to the very end, and it was like a treat for me. It was like a reward for doing the head down writing bit. And also it was a change of pace, which I really needed, because I literally started writing this a month after we moved here, and I'm surrounded by boxes and all the things I was meant to be doing, settling us in. And I felt very selfish, a little bit guilty as well, and it's quite an isolating pursuit. It can be writing. But what I was tending to do was, say to my husband, my long-suffering husband, right, I'm off out today. I'm going to be walking along the south coast from this beach to this beach. I'm taking the dog. I'll see you later on. And there are other times that I would go out on the kayak and we'd go together. And I'd be sitting there in the kayak. He'd be paddling on ahead, and I'd be stuck looking at a reed bed thinking, that reed bed, good God, look how it's moving. Look how it's bending. Listen to the sound. And I'd be making mental notes. And I really should have had a notebook with me, but I never did. It was really stupid, actually. A whole lot either, because by the time you get home,
yes,
it's important to making meals, feeding the dogs, getting everything sorted, putting the washing on, the usual domestic stuff.
Yeah.
You have to really rattle your brain to shake up the grains back to the grains of thought that you were thinking when you went back to that. So it's really interesting. There's definitely a process.
And yes,
I'm not an experienced writer. And I think the likes of, not that I'm likening myself to these people, I hasten to add, but the people like, we all know of, like J.K. Rowling, or, my mind's gone blank, surprise, surprise.
Other authors.
Other authors, Inc. Yes. have experience, and they probably do have a very, very disciplined and organized approach. I haven't got it yet.
I don't know, Anna. You know, I have been, I mean, I read a lot of books about writing. I love them. And I listen to podcasts, and especially female authors who are still in the child rearing years and the domestic responsibility years. Yeah. I think we all pretty much sound the same. We're writing in the fringe hours. We are going out for long walks for inspiration. We're quickly getting down stuff. Sometimes it's meeting deadlines, long nights, and actually we're still coming up with the goods. We're still, and it is actually, that was such a helpful, what you just explained, and kind of the image of that, of how you actually get stuff done. It's actually quite hopeful for people, I think. I think you often imagine people may have creative ideas, they may have creative passions, but they've got a toddler on their hip and they've got, you know, children all over the place, and they're thinking, I can't do this until, and you kind of had this, and I know it's harder when they're around all day, but you know, many, many amazing, incredible creative women are getting their work out there. And I love that we're starting to have more of these conversations saying, actually, this is the reality, that we still, just because you've given birth doesn't mean you haven't got the ability to get creative work out there.
Very good at juggling. If I can just interrupt, it reminds me of a perfect example of a friend of mine who is the most extraordinary inspirational woman, who can look around a strip of grass, a hedgerow, and she can tell exactly what is in that hedgerow or that strip of grass. And it could be on the roadside, it could be in a ditch, it could be on the motorway, it could be anywhere. And she will tell you what's edible in there.
Wow.
And about foraging. And that book was sitting in her for the first 4 or 5 years that I knew her. And she said, but you know, it's driving me mad. I've got my kids there, 3 and 5 and 2 or something. And she said, I don't know how I'm ever going to get this out. I said, just bear with me. Honestly, you will get them. We used to have these chats on the phone where she'd say, will it ever come? And it did. And last year, was it the beginning of this year? She published her first book to huge acclaim. She got it out. And her kids are, I think the youngest is probably now 6, maybe 5 or 6, but she got there.
Wow. Is she in Northern Ireland?
Sorry?
Is she in Northern Ireland?
No. She's up north near Monmouthshire.
Oh, okay.
But she just had to wait. And it was,
yes.
She didn't know how long she had to wait. But she, you know, it was just a matter of time. She didn't have to let go of it. It was just a matter of time.
Yeah. That's such an important lesson, isn't it? And so helpful. I'm sure many people listening will be appreciative of that. Yeah, it's so great. So, okay, I've got these two books in my hand, which I will show on Instagram when we advertise this, when I promote this post, but they look, I mean, they are just so beautiful together. I feel like there should be, you know, a whole series of like 8 of them all next to each other, because the aesthetics are beautiful, the feel of the book in your hand. Did you have a lot to do with all that part of the book as well? Did you get to say, I'd like this embossed, I'd like a ribbon in there?
All of that. And I think they were incredibly patient with me, because every time I mentioned ribbon or embossing or quarter binding in cloth, I could see them shrinking, because they were the ones that are going to have to go back to their budgeting team and try and justify that extra expenditure, because it is hugely expensive on a larger scale. You know, the odd book here or there.
As
you go into the print production, oh my God. So they were having kittens, but you know, they were amazing. Good as their word. And I think it's because it was an art-linked book. They realised right from the get-go that it needed to look like an art link book. It needed to look like a sketchbook with the sort of the cardboard or rough brown paper outside. I wanted it to look like the sort of thing I might take notes in and scribble in.
Yes, and it does have that feel. I remember opening from Field and Forest the first time thinking, oh, it just felt like this fantastic sketchbook. So, okay, I want to talk a little bit about, many of our listeners are not only for themselves, but their families and children, a big part of their life is getting outside, exploring in nature, having, you know, the outdoor world being our classroom. I can see obviously that's a big part of your life. And how does that, you know, how important is the outdoor life for your creative process, whether you're writing a book or not, or working or not? What does that do for you? How important is it for you to get outside?
It's what makes my writing work. It's what makes my illustration work. If I didn't have that outside influence, or if I hadn't have had it from an early age, I think I would be illustrating, writing, but it would be a different topic if I'd been inspired by something else. And then there's things to draw from all around you, even if you are living in a town. You know, there's still nature. You maybe have to go and seek it out a bit more. But as I said about my friend, she could find nature just looking in a ditch. She was extraordinary. Maybe she's an exception to the rule, but there's no bigger truth than to say that for me, going outside, it expands my visual horizon, which allows an expansion of my mind at the same time. The two are definitely correlated. And in terms of the seasons, you can still observe the seasons, even on a minute scale. And I found when I had youngsters, and I do the same for me, by looking at a plant or a tree and observing how it changes, allows you a micro level look at a seasonal interaction and a seasonal effect. And by noticing it, it gives you an idea on the grander scale. So even if you can't access a field or a forest or the coast, you can observe nature through the seasons. And there's a big comfort level, I think, to be had, even observing on a tiny scale like that. Because if you clocked that a daisy is just a shoot, then a bud, then a flower, then it literally folds up, closes in on itself at nighttime, then opens out again. And eventually it runs out of puff and it all but disappears back into the ground because you followed it all the way through. The next time winter changes into spring and you can recognize then that daisy plant, the leaves, and you can see that it's going to happen again. And there's a huge comfort to be had. So anybody with a seasonal sadness disorder, or people who find it difficult in winter, those little indicators are almost a reassurance that it's happening again. The season will come, spring will come, and summer will follow. And it's by noticing those little details in spring, in winter, in summer, or I should say those in the order of the season that happen, just to observe what happens to that one plant.
Yeah. It's so important. I remember I interviewed Nina Constable, who's nature filmmaker in the UK, and she was saying how during lockdown this huge push of, you know, if you can, for those who can, we had our little allocated walk time, didn't we? But just get outside. I mean, for people's mental and emotional well-being, you know, whatever season we're in, we all know as soon as we step outside and breathing that fresh air, or even, I mean, for me, I made sure that I invested in a really good raincoat, which you have to here in the UK, because, you know, no excuses, you can still get out there and get into nature and just observe what you can. And yeah, I love what you're saying about the daisy as well. I think when my children were little, they were always fascinated by the daisy closing its eyes at night, you know, closing up, and then when the sun came out, opening up again. And there's so many beautiful visual things that our children can get, can just be captured by, can't they, from a very young age. Yeah. I was reading this week about, I'm trying to think now, this guy was talking about aesthetic appreciation, kind of, the real work is done before adolescence. So actually those childhood years are really, really important for, you know, being outside, learning those observational skills, learning how to pay attention, how to hear, listen for bird song, look for changes in seasons, because once they hit adolescence, there are so many other things to capture their attention, aren't there?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think from a really early age to allow the child to take comfort from the fact that they are part of a bigger scheme can be so inspiring for them. And if they can maintain that throughout their young into adult life, I think that's really key because, you know, looking at, I mean, my book was never meant to be about mental health, but I know it's been bracketed in that sector because it does deal with my own mental health, if you like, not directly, but there are stories within there of me as a child and growing up to become an adult and what I went through, what a lot of us go through, which is senses of times when you're not quite so happy, possibly feeling insecure about your body as it changes into young adulthood. There's lots of things. There's a huge onslaught of emotions that occur as you change from a toddler to a child to a young adult, and a young adult to a fully grown, supposedly fully grown, although I don't feel that way.
No.
So to enrich your viewpoint as often as possible with a broader, more holistic view of your surroundings and observing your surroundings and the minutiae as well as the grand scheme of things, I think is really key. So you're not, yes, you're not alone.
Yeah, that's so helpful. So I just want to go back to what you were saying about your child, your school years. And I was born in 1975, so I was in school in the early 80s. It was similar way of thinking of you did science or art. We can see from your work that you have, you know, intrinsically connected the two. When you are illustrating something from nature, are your skills, I guess your understanding of what you're painting, do you do that purely from observation, or do you spend some time studying about that species? Do you do the work there, or is it purely from just looking, watching, taking notes, drawing?
It's both. It's okay. I want to know about the beastie. For instance, if I'm drawing a bee fly, I think I'm trying to look at the page number. There's a bee fly in my book, which is a remarkable little creature, but I knew nothing about them apart from the fact that they do look like a bee. And I keep bees. I haven't got them at the moment, but where I used to live, I kept bees. And I was thinking, God, that looks exactly like a bee. And
yeah,
this huge long proboscis. What does it do with it? What does it do? And it has pretty filthy, vile habits, actually, but it looks so cuddly and gorgeous. So I want to illustrate it. But of course, it's difficult to have an empathy for something and therefore be able to portray it, for me personally, and be able to portray it realistically unless I know how it came to exist that way. And so I did do my homework on it. And I do that pretty much with everything. Even if I can't have the real thing in front of me, and I can only have reference photographs that I've taken previously, I will do my homework to understand a bit more about it. Yeah.
So can we ask what happened to the bees? Because I loved that story. I thought you brought them with you.
I would have loved to have done. They got a disease, and I believe it was contaminated by a farmer living nearby who sprayed his crop. And so all three hives dwindled.
Oh, no.
But, you know, it wasn't illegal at that time because they had a certain loophole that if they were on an industrial scale farming, the country was reliant on them producing it, blah, 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 blah. But they were allowed to use certain pesticides. But unfortunately, it really messes with the bees' neurological inbuilt sort of navigational system, and they became lazy, dysfunctional. It was just so saddening, so saddening,
so sad. Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that. I have a friend who's recently, well, she's in her second year, and she's just had to split the hive, and they're growing, and she's been telling me all about it. Very exciting. Yeah.
I'll get them again, but I'm doing a recce at the moment of the local farms to see what they're planting and try and find out very quietly without upsetting anybody whether they spray, because if they do, I probably won't keep bees again. We have a supply of different bees, sort of solitary bees, bumblebees, a very different kind here, so many more than we ever had in Sussex.
Okay.
If I don't ever keep bees again, it would be sad, but I would never want to put them in the line of fire like I did in Sussex, unwittingly, albeit.
Yeah. Mm. Well, we shall keep us posted on your bee activity. I'd love to know, Anna. I think you're such an inspiration in your work, and from what you share on Instagram. Well, I love your passion for outdoors life and the water. But who inspires you? Even over the years, I guess, with art and even your writing, who has been an inspiration to you over the years?
Well, right off the top of my head, I would say there's one amazing biological illustrator called Ernst Haeckel.
Hmm.
Definitely worth looking up if anybody's listening.
Yeah.
Illustrations of underwater life is just utterly mouthwatering. I couldn't say more. Definitely look him up. On the other extreme of things, more sort of heartfelt, but equally impactful, would be Georgia O'Keeffe, and she uses oil paints like I've never seen before. And the presumption is it's always guided towards the female anatomy. And actually, on an interview, she said very, very firmly, it's not, but people will see what they want to see.
Mm.
Close-ups of the stamen and the petals of a flower, and they are exquisite. But she didn't just paint those, she painted all sorts of things. But there are two extremes, and I'm somewhere in the middle, taking vast inspiration from both of them. And I can only dream of the dizzy heights of their skills. But maybe when I'm, older and even greyer, that I might actually... As far as writing goes, I'm just going to walk to my bookshelf now. Hold on a second.
Yes.
Right, so we got... wonderful book here. I know you can hear me, sorry.
No, it's fine, we can hear you.
There is a beautiful book written by a guy called J.B. Priestley.
Okay.
And he wrote his Book of Delights. And there's been a modern day version tried to produce it for a charity, and it's a wonderful version with lots of different well-known writers writing their piece. It's essentially a gathering of essays on the splendid, quiet magnificence of things that go on around you. Doesn't necessarily lead. And he wrote it because everyone in his family believed him to be a grumpy old devil. Writing this book by way of apology to my family, and also to show them that I do have a lighter side. And they are exquisite, very short little stories, some only 300-400 words long, very readable, a story a night before you go to bed. Very inspiring Book of Delights, seeing the good things, observing the good things that are going on around you, that you might just otherwise miss. It's a really good book for concentration. The Peace of Wild Things. Wendell Berry has the most...
Oh, one of my favourites, yes.
Yes, I mean, that is the most beautiful essay. I call it an essay, even though it's a poem. It resonates so well. Another one. Oh, anyway, I could read you chapter on chapter of his beautiful work. Seamus Heaney.
Yep.
Absolute classic. That make you sit and ponder for a very long time. Mary Oliver.
Yes.
Alan Jenkins is another one. You may have heard of him. He's the editor of the Observer Food magazine. But he's much more than that. He is a brilliant writer. He wrote the most moving book, The Story of His Childhood. And it was centered around little passages of observation and hands-on work within his plot in London, his vegetable plot. And it's dipping back and forth into history, his experience as an orphan, and his different adoptive parents and the journey he took from adult to childhood, and particularly big journey over the last few years as he tries to reconcile what happened to him as a child and where he is now within his life. Really inspiring, very emotive book. But all these books together, all these writers have an element within them of small detail observation, those things which you could quite easily miss.
Yes.
Just take time out, make the time stand still a bit, and look. Just look.
I love that. How amazing. You're in very good company. I know many people listening today, Anna, are fans of Wendell Berry, Mary Oliver, and I'm sure we'll be scribbling down all your recommendations. But I remember listening to an interview with Mary Oliver on the podcast On Being with Krista Tippett. I don't know if you've ever heard that interview. I'll have to send it to you if you haven't. You'll love it. But it's one of the, she wasn't often interviewed. And it was one that was a few years before she died. But she's talking about the poem, one of her most famous ones, I think, A Summer's Day. And she was describing to Krista how the actual, what was going on, the visual image of when she was writing that. And I think that the line that everyone remembers is, what will you do with your one wild and something life? I think everyone's finishing my sentence right now. It's not on the forefront of my mind, but she actually had a grasshopper on her finger and she was eating cake and the grasshopper was eating a little bit of the cake. And it's these tiny details that you wouldn't have known that was going on when you read that poem. But actually what you were saying about the attentive writer and the writer and the artists and the creators that pay attention to the change of the seasons, an insect on the table, the swifts first, you can hear them in England, they're the things I listen out for, and they capture our hearts, don't they? And when they're written down in verse or in short essays or we see them visually, they're the things that really capture our hearts, and really I know for me, I want to share those with my children and with kindred friends around me. We pass these books around, and your shelves look very similar, sound very similar to mine. I love it. Thank you for sharing some more authors. We generally, with every podcast, people always say to me, Leah, you've made me spend money again because I've gone and bought lots more books.
There's nothing wrong with getting another book.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of books, let's talk about your two books here, Anna. I did have a little search to make sure you hadn't written any more that I didn't know about. I couldn't find any. Have you written any others that we don't know about?
I'm just racing back from my bookshelf.
That's all right.
Copies. No, I haven't. I've illustrated something else, isn't it? It was definitely time to illustrate my own. I think that drove me a lot of the time, actually, yes.
Yeah, so we've got From Field and Forest, an Artist's Year in Paint and Pen, and the same tagline for From Coast and Cove. Did you have both ideas at the same time, or did one come immediately after the other? Because they're so, I mean, they just, you know, it feels like a two-book instant deal series, or was it not like that?
It was a bit like that. I went into the publishers for our first ever meeting, and they were incredibly kind, gave me the time, sat there with my agent, and they said, and do you have any other ideas? I said, well, I was brought up on the north coast of Cornwall, and I said, it would make sense if we're doing From Field to Forest, or Field and Forest, that we do something about the coast. Maybe it could be called From Coast and Cove.
Wow.
And they said, are you sure you don't want to do the Coast and Cove one first? Because we think that one will be a real seller. Hang on, let's just slow down a bit. I've got Field and Forest right here. Oh no, I've really blown it now. You know, I've got my powder dry. But they were very enthusiastic. And, you know, I thought, well, she said, you know, we would love to do the next one, but obviously it's all hinged upon how well the first one did. And it sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but
no, blow it away.
I was still in shock because literally the first one was published and I got a call within days from my agent to say, okay, so now they'd like to talk about the next one. Like, wow. Now. And the thing was, we were living in Sussex. And I was thinking, oh, this is quite nice. I could go down and stay with mum and dad for, you know, a week every month, do all my beach walks and everything else like that, to revisit old haunts, and then write down there, have a week of writing, then come back again. And I looked at Mark. I said, what do you think? Does that sound like it? We could definitely work something out. And then lo and behold, lockdown came. We both realised working from home, we didn't need to be in the southeast of England, and that our kids were all old enough that they weren't necessarily schooling there anymore either.
Yeah.
Why are we still living here when we both like the coast? You want to go back nearer to living near Cornwall. I used to sail on the south coast of England a lot. Why don't we just talk about it? And within a month of that chat, we found somewhere. We put our house on the market.
Wow.
Moved house within 3 or 4 months after then.
That's so quick.
Really quick. And it was really shockingly quick. It took me a while to actually, when we arrived, to realise that we'd arrived. Because it was so quick. But of course, it presented me with a perfect palette now to take from to begin my next book. It was,
wow. I
was very lucky to have landed on the right side of the next book. Yeah.
Yes. So both books are split into seasons. And as I, when I tagged you in, when I received from Coast to Cove, I did say to you, I actually religiously read your books in the correct season and I cannot read ahead.
I'm so flattered. And of course, this is the right way to read it. And here I am pumping out this book in spring and they both start in autumn because yes. I end on the most rejoiceful season of the year, which is, you know, it's full blown, you know, rocket into summer with all the colors and the fruit, and you know, it, every book should end on a high was always my feeling. So
yes. Yeah. So I want to just highly recommend them, as, and you did have a fantastic endorsement from Nigel Slater, which is very exciting, isn't it? And you know, I'm going to obviously link to them in the notes, but I really encourage the listeners, grab yourself the copy of both the books because they are beautiful. And I can't finish this conversation, Anna, without asking you a little bit about egg tempera. Is that the correct way to pronounce it?
It is, rather than tempera, which is a batter that you dip your fish in.
That's right. I said it right. So this is you work in watercolor, pen and ink, oils, but egg tempera, is this a recent addition to your how you work?
It would be on the grand scheme of things. As I said, I've been illustrating now for, I would think, probably about 32 years. And it was only in the last 8 years that I really started looking at egg tempera. And here's the sad fact of it. I obviously wasn't ready at the time, but my husband bought me my little pots that are all lined up here and on the shelves in front of me. He bought me the majority of those about 25 years ago. He said, I hear about this thing called egg tempera. You should really have a look at it. I think you'd love it. And I said, oh, I haven't got time for it now. I'm doing watercolor. And, you know, I've got to get this work done on time. And the publisher wants me to do this. And I, you know, time is money, blah, 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 blah. So I was actually giving excuses. Yeah. Terrified of trying something new. I'll be honest with you. I just was too freaked out about the idea of trying something new. And about 8 years ago, I just got a grip of myself. I thought, well, things have calmed down a bit. The kids are all older. I'm trickling in the money from my illustrating. Everything is calm. I could actually find some time to have a go. And so I tried to look on the internet and find some videos. There was nothing really. So I thought, I'll have a splosh around and have a go. And I found someone had written about it's all to do with egg yolk. And I thought, oh God, what am I supposed to do with an egg yolk? So I had a go. And by just many, many mess ups and lots of bad judgment, I eventually found an element of success. And as soon as you find, it's like anything, as soon as you find that small element of success, it's like a reward for your hard work.
Yeah.
Tiniest little bit of success. And it girds you on to just really keep on going with it. So I kept on going with it. And now I would be hard pressed to find any other medium that I enjoy quite so much. Maybe oil paints on a grand scale. I love painting in oils, but for these detailed works, the iridescent quality that the egg gives each image and the deep luster that it sort of cloaks all colours with is so utterly intoxicating that I'm literally, you know, I'm pulling down the colours off the shelf, almost salivating before I even start to sit down and paint.
Wow.
They are so beautiful. It's like someone showing you a box and saying, inside here are the gems of the world. There's someone has collected them and you're going to open them up now. And it's all dark. The box is dark, no lacquering, very dull, boring box. They place it in front of you and you unlock it and you open it up and it's like, pow, there are the colours.
Wow.
And they're all born from, originally, none of them are probably synthetic now, but originally they would have been, the derivatives would have been metal oxides and stones that have been ground down to a very fine sort of pasta flour consistency, you know, 00, that pasta, fine grade pasta flour.
Yeah.
They're kept in jars, you keep them out of the light so the light doesn't go. But they used to use things like, well, the most obvious one that many people will know about would be the little beetle, the cochineal beetle that has a red shell. And they would grind down the shells of these beetles. It sounds very mean now, of course, very non-PC. But that red was vibrant, almost blood-like, but rich, so rich. And so colours would be brought from lots of different areas. It wouldn't just be rock. It would be sometimes earth. You've got the ochre. You've got burnt sienna. There's a stone that's used within sienna that is forms the basis of my colour that I have here called sienna.
Wow.
Beat it to make it burn and darken, and that's what I use there. There's lapis lazuli, which obviously is a rarefied stone now, semi-precious, and I think it's Afghanistan is probably pretty much the only place you can find it now. It's a very expensive stone, but you only need the smallest amount ground up and it makes the most beautiful blue, extraordinary blue, and I think I've written about it in Field and Forest.
Yes, yeah. I did research a bit after I discovered you use this form, and I'd never come across it before. And I think as well, just watch, I think this week, is it this week you've been painting the eggs?
I have.
On Instagram?
Yes, and I've been using lapis lazuli.
Right. So that, listeners, if you go over onto Anna's Instagram, and I will link to that as well, but I have been quite in awe of your patience and the layering process. Just think, it's actually quite meditative. You should make more and more videos so we can watch you do this slow. I think it's, yeah, it would be a great meditation technique just to watch someone paint.
It is quite, everything else gets, that's another thing actually, when you do any form of art, I think using your hands allows you to, I used that word corridor earlier on, and it's in a positive sense here, in that it corridors your mind in one dimension. So it actually doesn't allow you to let it wander off in areas of stress or things that are challenging you. And very often you'll find, or I definitely find when I'm working with my hands and so focused on something, that solutions come to challenges while you're working, because you stopped the momentary freeze on your brain, which you get when you panic, I think, that it freezes your brain from actually thinking of solutions. So painting or any form of art, I think, probably allows you to do that quite effectively if you just get wholly involved in it. Definitely benefit.
Absolutely wonderful. Anna, this has been such an enlightening, interesting conversation, and I'm sure I could honestly talk all night, all afternoon, but I won't keep you on this beautiful day any longer. But where can people, where's the best place to find you online if people want to connect with you? Obviously, I'll send links to the books, but where else can they connect with you?
I am on Twitter, and I try and put a bit of good news on Twitter on a daily basis, something wholly unrelated to the usual politics that's being battered around on there. So I try and do only good news on Twitter. Mm-hmm. On Instagram, you can find me under the same name, which is Grem Koska, G-R-E-M for mother, K-O-S for sugar, K-A, Grem Koska. And I do a similar thing, but I've got much more sort of art related stuff there and lots of stuff of, you know, what's going on in my life. So there'll be a bit of rowing, a bit of swimming, a bit of beach finds, a bit of treasure, a bit of seaweed, a bit of cooking once in a while, a bit of my dog.
Yes, we like dogs.
It's a very real look. So it won't just all be art based, because I think, well, that's not how I think.
It's great. I've really enjoyed following your days in Devon. It's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us in conversation today. And I'm going to, guys, please go and buy Anna's books. Enjoy them, because they take you through a whole year. Thank you, Anna.
Lovely to talk.